The following is an interview with Everett Sammons by Virginia Hanna for the Oral History Commission of Kentucky. The interview was conducted in Wheelersburg, Ohio, at the home of Mr. Sammons on August the 7th, 1978. The 6th, wasn't it?
My name is Everett Sammons, date of birth of July 26, 1910. My parents were Minnie Alice Crum, Jonathan Sam. My father was born on Big Sandy, and my mother was born Honeywell. I have five brothers and a sister. I've got a brother in Guinea County and a brother in Cold Boulevard. I have one sister deceased and one brother. Brother in Arizona and a sister in Fulton, Kentucky. My favorite teachers were Miss Lily Nichol, Mrs. Crawford. My parents were on a farm. We lived on a farm many years. And when I got married, I was married to Sam Fitz Hensler Tooley on May 6, 1931. Went to Housekeeping and Fields Edition, New Boston. I was working the brick plant. Although I worked many years on the farm. That was back in horse-drawn tool days when you checked your corn by hand and hauled it in and shoved it in the crib. I worked the big plant for several years and got laid off, and I went to and farmed office, and they sent me to the steel mill. And that's how I got in the mill. I worked in the mill till I retired. 1975, July the 26th. One of the comical things in life growing up was I'd work in a brick plant, my brother and I, for William Brick. We were going in the drive door and through a door and back out into the kill. And we were passing each other right about the same place all the time on the walkway. So the kill farmer, the name was Logan Counts, standing there, he was killed for him, and he told a couple of fellas came in there, and they were talking to him, and directly he came down to kill and said, "Boy," he said, "I'm going to tell you something." And I told him, I said, "Now, Mr. Counts," I said, "I can't hardly afford to stop." I said, "The girl's crowding pretty heavy, and I don't want to be late. It's Saturday, and we'd like you done." He said, "Well," he said, "it's going to take but a minute." I said, "I'd like to tell you." The girl come in, and Mr. Count told him, "You want to tell us something?" So he waited and unloaded his wheel bar, and he straightened up and said, "Well, all right, Mr. Count, what is it?" So he thought him and said, "You know," said, "been too far standing out there on the walks, and when you boys are wheeling bricks pretty hard." And he said, "Yes." Well, he said, they stood there and talked to me and said they watched you all the time, every time I went by. Of course, we were both dressed just exactly alike. And he said, "Well," said the, this boss said, "Well," said, "I come in here to ask for a job." He said, "I know a job wouldn't do me any good here because the way he works," he said, "I could never stand it." He said, "I don't see how he does it." And Mr. Count said, "Well," said, the way he travels, said you'd think he's two of them. So that was not only the one thing, but did any more work?
That's a good story. You were going to tell me something there about the way you had school and some of the things that Miss Ludie Nichols done there.
Well, she was a great person for a child to get an education. She wanted to do and have their tests on their schooling, so whatever she gave them for the lesson for the next day, well, then chances are if it was spelling, well, she'd have a spelling match. If it was arithmetic, she'd have an arithmetic match. But it was always on your lesson. And she would never let my twin brother and me be on the same side in the choose up match, because we was well as good or better than some of them.
He is about equal in intelligence, I bet.
That's right. And just whichever one just started first in adding or multiplying problem why they got it. So she'd always go in her husband's room and get his 6th and 7th grade and bring him up to finish out the match.
Did you get to go to school pretty steady, or did you have to miss a lot?
No, I missed quite a bit. See, them days we didn't have a school bus or a food program or anything like that. We took her little lard bucket and carried it to school with what we had for dinner at home, what we'd have for dinner there.
What kind of a work did your dad and mom do to raise that many children?
Well, mother, she worked for people, and we worked on a farm. And after we grew up to get pretty good size, the youngest ones of us, why, Dad went to work with people, paving brick company.
But while he was little, he farmed.
He farmed and made cross ties in the wintertime.
How many acres did they have?
Well, I think it came to about 50 acres, mostly hill.
Mm-hmm.
And we raised turkeys and chickens, hogs. Hogs had them on beef and pork.
Now, turkeys is a hard thing to raise, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Especially in them days when, in where we were, why they would go wild so bad. They'd go up on the hill and they'd fly from one hill to another, and then they'd steal their nests out, and sometimes you'd find them, sometimes you didn't. And they were pretty hard to raise that way, because turkeys would leave their young out in the dew, and they take a root and so forth, and they just don't thrive like they do, like the victim now, and incubators and so forth.
Well, I've heard it said that they were about the only kind of fowl or animal that had to be taught to eat. You had to put shiny things, marbles or pieces of metal, in their feed trough. Is that true?
No, I don't think that's all together.
Might help a little bit,
yeah,
though.
Might help a little bit, but I think it's, you didn't have any put in front of those that was hatched out on the hills.
That's right.
Tree stump or something.
Now, I know that for many, many years you lived at St. Paul. Now, how did you happen to go down to St. Paul, Kentucky, to live?
Well, as my brother-in-law now wasn't then, his daddy bought him a new car, and he was going to quit drinking. That point was, he was to quit drinking if he'd buy him the car. So he bought him the car, and all the boys he loved with, while they drank, of course, he was working, scrapyard. And I don't know how come, but we got together there one Sunday, and he got to ask me to show him how to teach him how to drive. And a couple of boys was talking to him about it while they kind of wasn't leading just up to facts of driving. So I got in the roadster with him and showed him, explained to him. And we rode around there a little bit, and a couple of boys wanted to go to St. Paul, and Bill, he agreed to take it. So when he took them down there, went down there, that's how I met my wife to be.
Now, you said Bill, and you also said that it was your one day going to be your brother-in-law. Who is that Bill?
William Henson.
And who did he marry?
He married Louise Tudor.
Now, you mentioned a roadster there. You don't hear of roadsters anymore. Now, I know what a roadster is, but somebody in later years might hear this tape and not know, would you? Just describe it for me.
It was a 29 Model A roadster for the Rumble City. Very popular, even is today.
Now, what's different about a roadster that you wouldn't see in today's car?
Well, a roadster is a cloth top. You can fold it down and you have an open car. And cars of today, the tops are built right on them, steel tops covered with cloth.
Well, like we call a convertible.
Well, that would be a roadster and a convertible are two different cars. And at that time, they built what they call a Phaeton. That was a touring car model thing. It used to call, when the Model T came out, well, they called them Model T touring cars. So when the Model A's came out, they called them a Phaeton, the four-door touring car. That was a soft top. You could fold the top down on it.
Now, this Rumble seat, would you describe that?
The Rumble seat takes the place of where your trunk is in your car. They just reverse the lid and make a seat in it. Then whenever you let the Rumble seat down, it's closed off just like a regular car.
Do you remember what people jokingly called the Rumble seat?
Mother-in-law seat.
Yes, I've heard it called that lots of times. When you first went to St. Paul to live, how big a place did you have? How many acres?
When we went to Peebles Edition first and lived 6 months in Peebles Edition. That's on Peebles Street in New Boston. And then we got a chance to buy a little place down there at St. Paul, so we went down there, and I think there was about an acre and a half around there, and it's been in the 37 flood. So we repaired it, fixed it up, and we got a chance then to get where my wife's father and mother live. So we bought it, moved up there, and sold the first place to my twin brother and his wife. We repaired this place up and overhauled it completely. In the meantime, then we got a chance to buy a piece of ground in the Bruce Bottoms, and my wife inherited a strip of ground. But it's 29 acres in the Bottoms. So then got this house fixed up, and that's where I installed my first bathroom, septic tank and all. Drove my own well. Piped it in. Then we got another place and we overhauled it completely. And after we got that pretty well done, I was getting about ready to retire. Electric company come in and took what land we had and bought a bill.
Now, did they just take your property, or was there others?
They took many others.
Have they done anything with that ground now?
Not I can understand, they haven't.
What crops did you raise there at St. Paul?
Corn, soybeans, different kinds of hay, cattle.
You mentioned there a little while ago that you bought, you got property from Mrs. Salmon's parents. What were their names?
May and Samuel
Tooley. Mm-hmm. Now, you have a lovely lady here with you, calls you Pop. Tell me about her.
Well, she's a great girl. She's been lots of enjoyment to us. She don't want to leave me. She wants to stay with her all the time. Wherever B goes, she wants to go. And I think she's, well, I don't think that she could have had a daughter that she was thinking more of.
Well, I know you feel the same way.
Right.
And what's her name?
Edna Carol Fibber.
Mm-hmm. You lived at St. Paul really longer than you ever lived any place else. Do you know how that place got its name?
No, I don't.
Was there any churches there in that particular area?
Two.
Would you tell me a little bit about them?
Well, Methodist Church was up above where we lived, and the Church of Christ was below where we lived. The Church of Christ was called the Christian Church when we first moved there, and many years after we lived there, they got a sign, Church of Christ. Well, I went down and helped put on the church. But I always help both churches.
Mm-hmm.
Roofing or anything.
Now, one time I saw an article in the paper. I believe somebody was going to be buried in the cemetery yard, the churchyard there, at the cemetery at the Christian church, and the article in the paper said they were going to be buried at Mars Hill Church of Christ Cemetery. And I didn't know what that was, so I called your wife to inquire, because they had said St. Paul, but Mars Hill, and I didn't know Mars Hill. Now, can you enlighten me a little bit on that?
Well, not too much on what I've been told. The Mars Hill, that's got the name of the cemetery there, and carried over. And when they, I think they donated, Mr. McCoy, I think, donated the land to put the church on, and some people bought lots there and as cemetery lots, and it was known as Mars Hill Cemetery.
That's probably a Bible name. Mars Hill in the Bible,
mm-hmm.
I bet that, yes. Now, I know there wasn't a minority group as such in St. Paul, but we had, I believe, a fine friend and neighbor there that would be classified in the minority group. Do you know who I'm talking about?
No.
Well, I want you to just tell me something about Sally Bonzo.
Sally Bonzo was a colored lady. And I don't believe that she had an enemy anywhere, children or older people.
Now, I don't think that Sally thought that she was colored any more than we thought about her being colored.
No. I don't think it entered her mind like some people have the idea of colored and white. She was just part of the family.
Yes, everybody
and
loved
and was treated that way.
Now, in in our part of the state, we don't go into politics a great big lot and lose friendships and argue about it, but do you have any little interesting things you could put in there about the politics in Greenup County or in that particular area along there in northern Kentucky?
Well, I never had anything. My father was never into politics. I never even heard him and mother discuss politics. But one time when I was, well, we lived down in that little house there belonged to her mother and father before we got it. We lived there and a man came in there and he wanted me to vote for him. And he told me that I was a staunch party leader and he would know that if he could get me to work for him that I'd do him a lot of good. So I just nicked that in the bud right now. I told him, I said, now, if you want me to vote for you, you tell me what you would like to do if you get the office, and then I'll decide in your politics. I don't want to worry about them as long as you're a Democrat or Republican. And the poor father never made it. I never went along with politics. I think as much a Republican person as I do a Democrat person.
You know, I think the reason we didn't hear our parents talk about politics very much, they were so busy making a living and they were so interested in keeping their children out of trouble that they, what time they weren't working at their own job, they were busy finding something for us to do. Did you feel that way about
it? That's right.
They didn't have time to argue politics.
That's right.
I wanted to know if you ever saw people make molasses, sardines.
Sure have.
Well, tell me how they did.
My father made them several years when I was small, and after I grew up, after I was married, my father made sardines. It's a great night to make sorghum and make it in the right way, or get your cane prepared in the right time of year, not let no frost get your cane stalks, or your, let it get pretty cold at night on the sorghum. And then you have to know how to boil it off, can it? There's a difference in it. You take your cane, if it isn't quite ripe, you get a strong sorghum, or if the frost hits it a time or two, you get a strong dark sorghum, not light.
Was there any legends or old stories about the areas where you lived that you might relate to me?
My grandmother, when we were real small, she stayed with us. And I just had an uncle and an aunt. And my grandmother stayed with our family, Daddy and us. And she was a great hand to tell these great, enormous ghost stories. And we were small then when she was living, and she'd tell these tales, and we'd be almost afraid to go to bed at night. We'd all slip upstairs. One night, she'd tell them, and of course, we boys were young. We'd generally lay down on the floor and go to sleep. And then we'd have to get up, and of course you always had to go outside before you went upstairs. One night we went out, and instead of stopping, we just kept going right on up the holler. We went over where a well had been dug. Went into a bucket, woke me up, and I turned around and come back and realized where it was. Sometimes we'd go to bed and we wouldn't go to sleep till way in the night because we was scared of these spooks and so forth that my grandmother would tell us about. But she could always keep us quiet by telling us these tales.
Can you remember one to tell me?
I think that the one she told once to say, said she's going, my dad was going someplace and she went to get him. And some man was there in the field was going to scare a person, and he had a sheet over his body, and he raised up and then let that sheet float back down to the ground. Grandmother seen it, and she run back home, said she wasn't too old. She run back home and said, she didn't know what in the world happened. Said, so then Grandpa, he had to go out there to see what it was. So then he didn't see him, but the next day, the man told Grandpa about it.
Yeah, I think they done a lot of scaring with the sheets and the cemeteries.
Yes, the cemetery was more than any other place. Yes, they. I know when I was young fellas growing up, I was about age, I thought I could court the girl. Well, we went to the showboat and had to come back by the cemetery. And I don't know whether my feet ever touched the ground fast in the cemetery or not. I used to tell you what grandmother would tell us when we was little.
That's about the safest place you can be. There wasn't a soul in there to hurt a fella.
That's right. But they had been told where they was.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you thought you were about old enough to start going with the girls. Tell me if you know the difference in courting then and now.
Oh yes, there's quite a bit different. You walk the girls home, or you walk them to church and you walk them back, and now it's altogether different. You hardly ever go to church. It's altogether different now than it used to be. Courting the girls, I reckon, is not out of style. It's the same as it always was, but it just isn't the same.
Different modes of transportation.
That's right.
And the different ways they dress.
And different ways to go, different places to go. They always had somewhere now that they could go. Well, then, if a showboat came in, or if there was a show on at the movie, why, you'd have to go down there. Well, it was a silent movie, so you really had to look at the screen if you got anything out of the show. So it's quite a bit different now than it was then, the things that you, places you can go. And the entertainment you do have, if you want to go out for entertainment, they have much more now than they did then.
Everett, how much education did your parents have?
Well, I think Dad went about 6th or 7th grade.
In that day, that was a good education.
Yeah, that was a stable education at that time. And if you had a 8th grade education, then it was more than equal 12-year education now, as reading, writing, and arithmetic.
Back then, I believe it's true that after you'd gone through the 8th grade, you could go to the county seat and take the teacher's examination. And if you made a score of maybe 75% right on everything, you could get a 3rd class teacher's certificate. Right. Haven't you heard that?
Yes.
And I think the higher your score, the higher rank certificate you could have. And if you made a low score, you had to probably take that examination every year to get your certificate renewed. If you had a high score, am I right in saying this, that you got a certificate that was good for several more years?
Yeah. But then you could continue and go to school through the summer and better your salary, better your education too. You get more higher grade. But you did have to know your reading, writing, arithmetic when you took this?
Well, and going back to reading across the screen there at the movies, you sure had to have the reading ability, didn't
That's
you?
That's right. Now, we were talking about the color lady, Sally Bonjo. Her name was Sally Barnes, and she's taken in with the Bonjo family. And all the children at school, most Jerry would stop to see her and talk to her. She'd always have something for him, cookies or something. She'd always give the children something, and they all would go with her. Sometimes some of them would go with her to the store. And talking to my grandmother a while ago, she smoked a stone pipe, but she always kept the stone pipe hidden. She didn't expose it to anybody, so that nobody knew that she smoked. I was a great big boy for her when she smoked. And she always wore a dress. She had a pocket in her dress, and always wore an apron over her dress, and she kept this stone pipe in her dress pocket. And the Christian Church of St. Paul, the Church of Christ of St. Paul, was donated by the Melinda Bruce heirs. Mrs. McCoy was one of these heirs. She was quite a fellow in the church. And talked to my experience of people I live close to, was Waters family. Mr. Waters was a watermelon raiser. He raised lots of melons. He ran a store there at St. Paul. And at that time, I was married while he had a radio in his store. And we'd go up there in the evening, several of us. That was back in the early 30s. And we'd go up there and listen to Amos Manley. Just as soon as that was off, he'd turn that radio off, and he locked the store, and we'd all disperse and go home, and there would be ten of us up there. And Mr. John Black was a resident of St. Paul, and had been, was there long before I went there. And he was postmaster, and carried the mail when they used to hang it on a crane, and the mail coach would pick it up. And he also run a store there at St. Paul, and he sold his store out to Mr. Waters. Mrs. Stamper was born on January 1st, 1889. She's the woman who brought the lunch program to the school children. Well, when I was growing up, families were, I don't know, families seemed like we were quite a bit closer together then than they are now. That was the hardest time in life to actually get out of living in the country. And you really had to go, whatever you're doing, if you go help somebody or they come and help you do something, well, that was the way it was done in them days. Money was pretty scarce. And our store at St. Paul was owned by John Black and his brother. And then it was later years that they sold out to Mr. Waters and Van. And then he sold to Earl Hamilton, and Lewis Brown sold to Jar Brown. Jar Brown sold to Paul Beach, and they had the post office in there for quite a while. Then Paul Beach quit the store business and went into other work. And Elijah Green was first man buried in the cemetery of St. Paul. And Florence Fair was the first midwife. Her brother Texas Green drove the first school bus in community to transport students to Vicksburg to the hospital.
me ask you something about the Greens there. You mentioned that family. I've heard a little story about a bear that they had there. Are you familiar with that story?
Not too much. I was just told the story. The bear had been shot before I got down in that section of country.
Didn't the story go that he brought it from, that Mr. Green brought that from Michigan?
That was the way I got it.
And he shot it because it clawed his oldest grandchild, Maxine Green, who is now Swords. I believe that's the story I heard.
That's the way I heard it. She was real small when this happened.
Uh-huh. Well, Maxine is probably early 50s now, so yes, that would have been a long time ago.
Mr. Waters, the way he used watermelons, he put quite a bit in it. He bought fertilizers and so forth. Different kind of sprays to spray his melon vines with. I wasn't working too good at that time. Days I'd have off whenever the melons got ripe, or he'd always have me to help him gather them. We went over and gathered 250 one day, and of course we eat several. And we bought the truck over and loaded it. We took a box, put it on a sled, and took the horse and gathered them all up and put them in a pile. And then we took the truck there and loaded it up. Got the truck loaded up, and he started out with his truck and started missing. And he couldn't follow it. So he didn't know what in the world to do. I knew a little about a motor, but not too much. And he decided to go over and get Mr. Ben Bundle to bring his truck over and help him out. So Mr. Bundle brought his truck over, and we loaded 2/3 of the melons on his truck. And he taking them out, and Mr. Waters, directly, he came out with his truck, and it was missing pretty bad. And we got out to his house, and he said, "Everybody," he said, "I just have to get them melons to town 7:00 in the morning." And he said, "I know," he said, "that truck won't pull." And I said, "Well," I said, "we look at the motor." So I raised the hood and checked it over, and I decided that there's a valve stuck in it. And he said, "Well," he said, "what are we going to do?" I said, "Well," I said, "I don't know." I said, "not very good idea." I said, "I can unstick it," but I said, "it's liable to stick again as soon as you start it." And he said, "Well," he said, "that's the only hope I got." And I took the inspection plate off the motor and took the screwdriver and got the valve loose and put all around it. Worked it 2 or 3 times and then turned the key on and started it, and it didn't miss, so we loaded the melons all on it. Next morning, we lived out this way from where he had come past our house. And I heard him go out by real early in the morning, so then I got out. And we come back about noon, and it was still running good. But he was a great hand to give you melons. He wanted you to eat all the melons you wanted, and he'd always give you melons to take home. So I took several sugar melons and watermelons home, and my wife's first cousin came up, and his wife, and he went out there, and oh, he really had a good time. And them melons, he thought that was the greatest thing there was. I thought he was going to make himself sick, but he didn't. And eat melons and grapes. And we had a good time.
When you was growing up, Everett, now I know you see this daily now, where children argue with their parents. Did children argue with their parents and talk back to them when you were growing up?
No, I don't think so.
if they had it, how do you reckon they'd have handled it?
Well, it wouldn't have been, don't you do that anymore. I think it'd been a little more stricter than that.
Yes. So children just didn't rebel, did they?
No, children had always, they always had something to do. When they came home from school, they had chores to do, the milking to do, wood to get in for the next morning or something like that. And they always had something to do when they came in home. They didn't come in home and throw their coat on the porch and go to someone else's house or something like that. They had things to do. They had chores to do every night.
If anybody in your family had to be disciplined, who took care of it? Your mom or your dad?
Mostly my mother.
The older kids wasn't allowed to discipline the younger ones.
No.
You see that sometimes nowadays. When you started to work away from home, did your folks expect you to turn over any of your earnings to help out in the family?
Yes, that was the whole thing. That was why you went out and took these jobs a lot of times, was to help support the house.
What was the strongest point in family life as you knew it?
Well, I think that children, the first thing that we were taught, that is, at any age, is to respect their mother and father. And they were to make an example for us children of what we should do and what we shouldn't do.
And I've known you about as long as I've known anybody, and I know basically what your values are in life. I know you're a God-fearing man, you're a hard worker, you're honest, you love your family. Now, do you think that you just acquired these as time went along, or did your parents instill these attributes in you?
I think that was the starting point.
You took example then from them.
That's right.
Nothing happens just by accident then. You got it through example and also through doing.
Yes, you I think it's a daily procedure that you grew up to this thing.
Well, I know you wouldn't go out and steal anything. I know you know that's wrong and you just wouldn't do it. But did your parents explain why taking something that wasn't yours was wrong? Or did they just say, well, no, that's wrong to steal, just don't you do it?
Yes, one time I was shucking corn from there, and another boy there, school buddy, we went to check corn for this fellow. He left it out all winter. That something wasn't customary in them days. And we were shucking corn. It was all cutting in the shop. And there were some apple trees on the farm just below where we were shucking this corn. So that morning, I don't know, we'd shuck corn a day or two. And that morning, he told me, he said, get you a sack there. And I got me a sack. I didn't know what was going on. So I got me a sack, and he already had his sack, and so we went up and shucked corn that evening, or late that evening when they started to go home. He come down through with these apple trees, and he said, and I said, do you want to get a sack of apples here? He said, they don't care for you getting them. Well, I got me a sack of apples, and he got him a sack, and we started down about what a 14-year-old boy could carry. And we started down through the field, and then came out in the field riding on a horse. So he come up by us and spoke to us, asked us what we'd done. We told him, shutting the corn. So he said, well, what have you got in them sacks? So I just told him that apple in it. And he said, where'd you get them? Well, I showed him the tree. We got them all put up and told him that we 100 students to even care for to get him. He said, well, it's a dim apple growing for me. And he says, I do care. I said, well, I'll take them back. He said, yeah, he said, I'll take mine back. So he said, no, he said, you go ahead and take them home with you. He said, just tell your parents what you got them, how you got them. So I go home and laid the sack down and explained it to the apple in them. Told my mother that I got them and I wasn't supposed to get them, but I was under the impression I could have them. But the men came by on the horse and told us that we couldn't. You know, so he told them to bring one home and just tell you just how I got them. So now I've told you. And she said, well, I said, you know better than that. I said, don't bother anything, no wrong to it. And that was one of the experiences I had in growing up, to let things alone, don't wrong to it.
Now, you told me that when you first got married, you started living in New Boston, which was city living, and then, of course, most of the rest of the time, you've lived in the country. Now, which one did you like the best, and why?
I like Kentucky the best.
You let me. You like the state of Kentucky the best, and it, so consequently, I can assume that you like country living the best.
Right.
Well, give me some reasons there. There has to be some.
You live out in the country, right? Not too far out in the country. I don't want to be a car out away from everybody. But I like to have a little room, and then if I have a dog on the place, like, it can even get out the door before it gets on someone else. And I don't know, it's quieter that way, where you're not jammed up close together, real close to a heavy turnpike or something like that. It's more enjoyable.
Well, I had some lady tell me that she liked to live in the country best because if a chicken got in the flowers, it was her chicken and her flowers.
Well, that's right.
So
that's right.
That might make a good example.
That's right.
How old was you when your folks let you feel that you were a man?
Well, I was about 17 years old.
Do you think it depended on the child or whether all of them were considered grown up about 16 or 17?
Well, yes, in Kentucky, or I guess in any out of way in country, in any state, would be that way. But when I was about 16, 17 years old, they started to build South Shore over there. Well, they moved all that ground, all that dirt with new slip scrapers. And I was thinking that I was pretty well grown up because I had a weekly check coming in. And back in that time, why, a weekly check was something, because they worked 10 hours a day and drove team there and harness the mules in the morning and take them up to the job. Take them back at night and unharness them and feed them. Then they had a man there that took care of them in the morning to feed them and harness them. All you did was go down there and get them and take them back on the job. And we hauled the brick, fire brick Kentucky, with a dump wagon and a standard wagon. Made two trips a day. And the houses built in South Shore was materials was hauled from Utah Ridge and taken back on T.W.G. Hannah's painting mill in Fortune, planes, and then brought back to the job and they were built. Two of the main builders was John Adams and Jim Adams. And we worked on that job till it was finished, and then I worked in the garage for Robert Johnson quite a little while, in 1928 in January, went to Peabody Brick Plant, went to work.
You didn't work on the ferry boat?
Worked on the ferry boat, yes. About 6 months.
Okay, now I bet you can tell me something about that bridge being built that they're having so many problems with right now, the U.S. Grant Bridge.
Yes, I helped build the approach to the bridge on the Kentucky side, and they had international trucks there. At that time, they were solid tires, solid rubber tires, and they were chain driven. They didn't have a differential in them. They were worked off a gear and pulled each wheel. I think they were called 3-ton-and-a-half trucks. I know I was the smallest. I'd stand on the fender to drive one when we'd be backing up into the field to dump, in a hydraulic dump. And the bridge, when they built the bridge first, they had a wooden floor in it, walkway was wood, and I believe that material was shipped from California.
Now, you saw that bridge go up, and you know what kind of material was put into it and what kind of work was done on it. And I'd just like an opinion here now. Do you feel like it's as dangerous now, after 50 years, as people seem to think today that it is?
No.
You don't think it's that
no.
dangerous? Well, it's working quite a hardship on people on both sides of the river to have it closed, and I was just wondering about that.
Well, I think that little slip up in our engineering, because when the bridge was built, they built it for the traffic at that time, and the bridge today isn't sufficient for the traffic of this day.
You mentioned a while ago about your grandma coming to live with you. Now, under what circumstances did kin folks come to live with the family?
Well, my grandfather was dead, and grandmother didn't have anyone to take care of her, and she just didn't have the means to stay with herself.
Was she sickly, or was she able
to?
Well, no. Just that she didn't have the finances.
That's right. Uh-huh.
How did that affect your family's lifestyle?
Well, I don't think it affected it any. Grandmother pretty well took care of herself till she got pretty feeble, but when she first came to live with us, I think she's in a way an asset to the family, for she could take 3 or 4 of us boys, and she'd go out and she'd see that we got in Cameron or something like that, and in other words, she just kind of looked after us through the day.
Did she do any piecing of quilts and quilting and hooking rugs?
Well,
and that sort
not
of thing.
Too much. She wasn't, grandmother wasn't too much on something like that.
She's an outdoor gal, though.
Yes, more like she wanted to get outdoors. Go on the farm all the life.
She probably had a big influence on you.
Quite a bit. I can remember things today, that something maybe that she would, you know, the way she did things or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember her telling your parents how to raise the kids?
No. No, I think my father and mother did that.
Uh-huh. She wasn't the busybody then.
No,
just a good person.
She didn't take sides in children's arguments, or she didn't say when and how to discipline. No, that was, she didn't do that. Kept quiet.
In your growing up, did you ever know any little orphan children or widowed husband or wife that would that needed a place to stay, and How was that taken care of before the welfare programs come into
effect? Well, families mostly taking care of their ailing parents or grandparents, children in the case of that kind. Now, lots of times it'd be a family, say, that the father died and they'd be a pretty good sized family. Well, the neighborhood mostly pitched in to help take care of the orphan children.
Now I know that there wasn't as many divorces back then as there is today, but how did the community feel about people divorcing? Did they usually blame one or the other? Or?
Well, a few might, but the point in them days was if someone was having trouble, if you couldn't help them, don't hinder them. You should, if you've got some way that you can help them, fine. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have any way you can help them, don't meddle into the argument. You might get on the wrong side of the fence.
Well, now that'd be a good policy to live by today, wouldn't it?
That could be a good policy any time.
How old was you when you got married, Everett?
I was right from the 6th day of May to the 26th day of July, being 21.
Well, did your folks care for you getting married? How'd they react?
No. My mother liked me, and my father liked me. My mother didn't live till I was married. But my father got to talk to her several times.
But they didn't mind your getting married?
No.
Well, there was a time when people kind of frowned on old bachelors and old maids. Can you remember what the attitude was back when you were growing up of unmarried people?
Well, I don't know too much about that, but I don't think that there was much said then as there is now concerning the two.
Uh-huh. Well, do you think there was any difference in whether it was a man who didn't get married or whether it was a woman who didn't get married?
Well, it seemed like that they probably helped more so to if it was a man than it was if it was a woman. Uh-huh.
They thought women ought to get married.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got to get married.
The idea in them days was a woman's place was in the home.
Yes.
That was just a set pattern. And nowadays, why, women has a legality to do with their life what they want to. And I think it should be.
What kind of a marriage ceremony did you have?
Well, we had a preacher down here in Portsmouth married us. Very nice fellow.
Didn't
his wife witnessed the ceremony.
Yeah. Now, when you went home that night, did you have to set up for a bailing?
No. When we went home, I went back down to my wife's home, and I stayed all night, and I got up the next morning and went to work. And I stayed with my brother the whole week. Then I got laid off the last day of the week. And she came up to get me and went down and bailed her on Saturday night. Fall.
Now your boss didn't get mad at you for getting married, did he?
Oh, no.
Thought maybe that's why he laid you off.
He's a wonderful man.
No, I was teasing. Now this has been a fine interview, and I certainly do appreciate it. And you've told me a lot of things that has interested me over the years, and if you wouldn't care, I'd like to come back and talk to you and Mrs. Sammons again.
Well, I think that could be arranged anytime you want to come.
Well, now, I would like that, and I hope I've not tired you out today.
No, I've enjoyed it.
Well, it's certainly been my pleasure, and I thank you so very much.